This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If you're a person who has TV news on all day in the background, your occasional upward glance would have marked this week's biggest small screen story as the funeral of a 94-year-old man who was once president of the United States.
He fancied himself to be a good bass singer. He was not. We'll sing for our president.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
He was born to power and spent his life wielding it. But if not for those 4 years in the White House, the cameras would never have fixed so firmly all week long on his body in transit, flying up from Houston to D.C., lying in state in the Capitol Rotunda, gracing the Washington Cathedral, lifting off from Joint Base Andrews, landing at Houston's Ellington Field, and traveling still. Halting at St. Martin's Episcopal Church, rolling by motorcade to the Union Pacific Railway facility, rumbling by special train through small towns to College Station, pausing at Texas A&M University, and finally dropping anchor at the George Bush Presidential Library and Museum for eternity. It seemed to go on for a long, long time, but it was not unusual. I'm guessing that the endless stream of short, sharp shocks delivered by the news the last 2 years has left us too frantic for the measured pace of such events. There is a pattern to these presidential launches into the hereafter, each with its own theme and variations. The theme of this week's was summed up by Bush's Secretary of State and lifelong friend, James Baker.
His wish for a kinder, gentler nation was not a cynical political slogan. It came honest and unguarded from his soul.
That view from the podium was echoed by the pundits.
I think President Bush embodied this concept of being a gentleman.
We talk about the need for decency. That's exactly what this man was.
A strong, silent type, brave, even lethal if necessary, but not a braggart.
What George Bush recognized about America, which makes him to me the last gentleman in Washington, was that our political opponents aren't opponents at all. They're friends with whom we differ.
Consider the letter the 41st president left in the White House for the 42nd. It was a presidential tradition he carried out with true grace, read here by the recipient.
Don't let the critics discourage you or push you off course. You will be our president when you read this note. I wish you well. I wish your family well. Your success is our country's success. I'm rooting hard for you.
One of the stations of the crossing of a president into death is the tone and the timing of the summing up. Candid or kind? Now or later? Isn't now the best time to be forthright when more people actually care? Or do we delicately delay to spare the bereaved? Television, awash with pictures of veneration and tributes from the late president's admirers, made its choice long ago. And the timing has made it even easier in the case of George Herbert Walker Bush.
I think any historical figure, the way that they are remembered is so contingent upon what historical moment they pass away in. I think it's tethered to what he is not, and what he is not is Donald Trump.
Ann Helen Peterson is a senior culture writer and Western correspondent for BuzzFeed News.
So what George H.W. Bush is being remembered for, it's echoes of how John McCain was also remembered.
It's nostalgia wrapped up in eulogy. The C word is used a lot.
Civility.
Watching these things, you saw the recurrence of the Clinton letter, the civility theme. You were disturbed by it.
Do we remember those in power through how other people in power remember them? Or is it also important to think about, okay, how did the least of these, how were they affected? You know, the day that I was seeing those, Saturday, was also AIDS Remembrance Day, right? Mm-hmm. December 1st, every year. And so that juxtaposition led to a lot of people who were commenting on, oh, well, here was George H.W. Bush's legacy on AIDS, which is that, much like Reagan, he did not do enough. He did not act soon enough. What prompted him to act was not the suffering of gay men, but, you know, when it became associated with a young boy whose association with AIDS was not through sexual activity. So people who either were directly involved in that or are mindful of, you know, the actions of ACT UP, dumping ashes on the White House lawn during H.W.'s tenure.
Bring the dead to your door!
We won't take it anymore!
The purpose of these people coming here is because George Bush and his administration has done nothing with our lives, so we bring our dead to you, and they were determined to deposit the ashes of their loved ones on the White House steps.
Part of AIDS is one of the few diseases where behavior matters. And I once called on somebody, well, change your behavior. If the behavior you're using prone to cause AIDS, change the behavior. Next thing I know, one of these ACT UP groups is out saying, Bush ought to change his behavior. You can't talk about it rationally.
Peterson observed that to the overwhelming majority of citizens without power or direct acquaintance with the deceased, a president is not a person, but an event, one with vast and potent consequences for good or ill. So when assessing a presidency, kindness simply doesn't apply.
If you were talking about World War II, right, and you only talked about the good things, you talked about victory in Europe, and you never talked about dropping the atomic bomb, we would say that that is not accurate to the historical record.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't say you're being mean to World War II.
So what voices would you have included if you had to write the historical record of President George H.W. Bush?
A soldier who served in the first Gulf War, someone who lost a loved one to the AIDS crisis, someone who was sentenced under the war on drugs, but then also, you know, someone whose life was really changed by the Americans with Disabilities Act,
mm-hmm.
or who, after Bush signed the Ryan White Act into law, that made, you know, receiving AIDS treatment possible to them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a full cornucopia that's not just people who have covered them or other presidents or senators and that sort of thing. The piece that I saw that really did a good job of this is David Greenberg's piece in Politico.
Well, I think obituaries are often the first place that we turn when we want to learn about a historical figure.
David Greenberg is a professor of history, journalism, and media studies at Rutgers University and contributing editor to Politico magazine.
You know, we're not engaged in a discourse with the Bush family right now. We're engaged in a discourse with the American people and new generations who may be learning about President Bush's presidency and career for the first time.
Okay, you wrote a book about President Nixon. You watched the obituaries. You read them. You saw them when he died. He's about as complex a character as you could encounter.
With Richard Nixon, even more than with George Bush, you know, there was, I would call, almost a whitewash at the time of his funeral.
Roy Howard, you were the chief news editor for Newsweek in Washington. Richard Nixon didn't like you very much. Give us your first thoughts when he died. You knew it was coming.
Sadness, Peter. Richard Nixon accomplished a lot in his political career, opening the door to China, easing the tensions with the Soviet Union, peace in Vietnam, and brought a lot of good to the world. On the domestic front, he was very successful as a president. And the tragedy of Richard Nixon is that, most of all, he's going to be remembered from Watergate.
It was sort of hard to imagine from hearing some of the eulogies why this man has gone down in history in disgrace as the first president ever to resign, as someone who committed constitutional crimes and abused the powers of his office. It was almost as though it's just one part of the story.
So what was the main story in the eulogies of George Herbert Walker Bush that you think was left out?
The story we have been hearing is a man of great decency and bipartisanship. But in fact, that decency, which no doubt was part of who Bush was, most of the time lost out to political cynicism. When he wants to win in a Texas Senate race in 1964, he is denouncing the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which is one of the great achievements of modern politics.
He embraced supply-side economics that he had called voodoo economics during the campaign.
That's right. And he also threw aside his support for abortion rights because Reagan wanted him to. He dropped his support for the Equal Rights Amendment for women because Reagan wanted him to. So I see a pattern of repeatedly subordinating what we might call his nobler impulses, or at least his more liberal or moderate impulses, to political expediency.
I won't even bother mentioning the low of the Willie Horton ad during the campaign. It's probably been played ad nauseum at this point.
Bush liked to say, oh, yeah, during the campaign, I could get nasty. But once I was elected, you know, it was all pure governance from there on out. Well, it's never like that for Bush or for any president, that the pressures of politics weigh on particular decisions. He wasn't standing up for this older strain of republicanism. He was sacrificing it in the short term in the hope, perhaps, of being able to implement it in the long term, but that long term never came. What happened instead was the concessions that he made to the far right ended up only empowering the far right.
Greenberg notes that such vaunted Bush achievements as the Americans with Disabilities Act and amendments to the Clean Air Act were concessions. Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate. He wrote that George H.W. Bush often slunk aside to create space for far-right ideologues and practitioners of personal destruction, and that it shouldn't surprise us to see that others made of far more malignant stuff than he have now taken over that space. Where does a president or a powerful politician leave us? That is the essence of a legacy, and in this particular case, the role of eulogy. An event like a president is not a subject for public eulogizing like a film star. He, so far he, no longer belongs to his family or friends. A president, by dint of the power he wields, belongs to us all, and especially, as Peterson says, the least among us. Anything less betrays history, our chance to learn from it, choose better, and do better.
If you love you some infotainment, dive in to the Hot Stove League. That's the old-timey name for the rumor mill that follows every baseball season as teams acquire players for the next year, such as World Series hero Nate Eovaldi of the Boston Red Sox, who's been linked for the past month to the Brewers, Braves, Angels, White Sox, Blue Jays, Padres, Phillies, Giants, and Astros.
It's been a little over 5 weeks since we last saw the Astros play, but Houston is keeping their name in the headlines. The latest offseason news is their interest in acquiring free agent pitcher Nathan Eovaldi.
The problem is the fuel of the Hot Stove League is just scuttlebutt. Much of what passes for reporting is just repeating the tantalizing guesses of other outlets. It generates clicks, but insight? not much of that.
And this just in, Kenny Rosenthal tweeting off free agent right-hander pitcher Nathan Eovaldi in agreement with the Red Sox pending physical.
The Red Sox, oops. But of course, this is just sports. It's trivial. It's not as though the press would resort to third-hand speculation in matters of consequence, like, say, the fate of the President of the United States.
You know, whenever there's a ramping up of information, because we hardly get any information from this investigation, yeah, we start to wonder, okay, does that mean that they're wrapping things up? Yahoo News was reporting that, you know, perhaps they're tying up loose ends. Yeah. Any speculation here at all?
Welcome to the Hot Stove League Special Counsel Edition, where the vacuum of facts is filled with endless exercises in supposing.
It looks like Mueller is beginning to wrap things up.
The smart money is betting on soon.
Former FBI Director James Comey predicted that the Mueller investigation was in its fourth quarter. We're now seeing signs that might be the case.
Until Tuesday, the press focused on a sentencing memo from Michael Flynn, which we were told might be a play to preempt any quashing of Mueller's official report by acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker.
Flynn's sentencing memo, I think, will give us a lot of information about what he was doing working with the Russians. I don't know what that information will be, but I think we'll get a lot from that.
Nope.
Last night we expected a bombshell. Instead, we got a big teasing document with a lot of redacted material that tells us this guy's a canary.
And so attention immediately turned to Friday's filing in Paul Manafort's case.
It is expected that that would be a great chance for the special counsel to reveal more details about exactly what it was that Paul Manafort lied about. And that may give us some clues about where else the special counsel investigation is headed.
Look, something is going to happen with the Mueller investigation. Some guesswork will always end up seeming prescient, just as some outlets predicted Nate Eovaldi would stay in Boston. But journalism is supposed to be a brokerage of fact, not a game of chance.
So late Friday, we learned something, as we do. Mueller's latest filing says that Manafort lied multiple times, multiple ways. But the substance was, shall we say, heavily redacted. And Michael Cohen's probably going to the big house. If we'd only waited just a little, we wouldn't have to guess. This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When we think of Latin American migration, we think of refugees trekking northward toward the U.S. border. But there is also heavy traffic in the other direction. Buffeted by economic collapse, crime, political repression, and even starvation, an estimated 2.3 million Venezuelans have fled to Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, Brazil, Chile, and elsewhere. This week, for the first time, the United Nations included the Venezuelan crisis in its global humanitarian appeal, seeking aid for Latin American countries who have taken in Venezuelans. Indeed, as NPR's Spanish-language podcast Radio Ambulante reported this week, some nations are straining under the burden and are growing uneasy with the newcomers. Lima-based journalist Diego Salazar, who reported the piece with his wife, reporter Lizzie Cantu, says Peru had never been home to a lot of outsiders.
Let me give you this number in order for, you know, your audience to understand. Until 2016, all the foreigners in Peru were around 100,000 people from every country. Actually, there were more Americans than Venezuelans in Peru back in those days. Now we have 600,000 Venezuelans. So we have more than six times the amount of foreigners in the country.
And at first, Peru rose to the occasion.
The previous government, whose president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, said, please, Venezuelans, come to our country.
Venezolanos, bienvenidos al Perú.
We're going to pay you fair salaries. We are happy to have you here.
Los sueldos de ley.
And a new permit, which was called the Temporary Residence Permit, PTP, allowed Venezuelans to spend a year in the country. They were allowed to work with that ID while they were trying to change their migration situation to a regular migrant worker. And actually, when the government approved the PTP, almost 60% of Peruvians agree with it.
You have someone in your story talking about how beautiful the reception was from the people in the streets in Lima. Hugs.
Yeah, we interviewed this young Venezuelan named Ana Mer, who is a journalist. She arrived to Lima in October 2017. And at first, they were completely surprised about how welcoming people were, about how everybody in the streets recognized their accent and asked, oh, you are Venezuelans.
Tú eres venezolano. Ay, pobrecito.
We're so glad you are here. Please welcome to our country.
These were fellow Latin Americans in extremis, and Peru was going to offer them as much opportunity as it could.
I think there were three main reasons. The first one was because Venezuelans received Peruvians back in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, where Peru was going through a terrible economic crisis, and also we were facing the dangers of local terrorism. And a lot of Peruvians flew out the country, and some of them went to Venezuela. I think the second reason is from the early 2000s, Venezuela was kind of a scarecrow for Peruvian politicians. It was, you know, the far-left country, the socialist country, who was actually trying to intervene in Peruvian, and not only Peruvian, but all across the region, politics. So now Venezuela was in a deep crisis. Politicians were saying, look, this is what happened when you go full socialist. So Peruvians felt good about themselves. And the other reason, the third one, is Peru hasn't been a country who received a lot of migrants for a long time. We had migration in the early 20th century, but since then, we've been a country of migrants. We weren't in the receiving end.
And then things changed, like a lot.
In January and February this year, I started to notice that the way Peruvian media was covering Venezuelan migration was different. It wasn't anymore, you know, the celebration and the self-congratulation about how good we were because we were helping our brothers. It was different. It was about the way Peruvians and Venezuelans were colliding. You even have stories about a video where Venezuelans were saying they didn't like this or that Peruvian food, and newspapers were making news out of them. So one day, I was just checking Twitter, and I saw someone who posted this picture, which said, Venezolanos fuera del país, or we don't want more Venezuelans in Peru, Peru is only for Peruvians, or something like that.
Venezuelans had gone from being brothers to others. You are seeing the same patterns elsewhere?
Yeah, everywhere. Colombia is the country who has received the most Venezuelans. There are over 1 million Venezuelans in Colombia who has arrived in the last 2 years. The same is happening in Ecuador, Argentina, and Chile, and even Brazil. On a news show in Colombian television, there were these journalists who very early in the morning was reporting about a robbery. And he said, well, you know, the door woman said they were Venezuelans and actually they raped her.
Mucha atención porque denuncian a varios venezolanos que al parecer violaron a una mujer.
And a minute later, you have a police officer
tenían un acento venezolano
saying exactly the same in front of the camera. Well, one of the producers of Radio Ambulante has her office in that same building. So later that morning, when she arrived to work, She went to see the door woman. And this lady said, I didn't say they were Venezuelans, and they didn't rape me. So it was just a regular crime scene. The police turned that into an opportunity to blame Venezuelans, and media covered it and put it on national television.
It's hard to imagine somebody saying without evidence that Venezuelans are rapists and murderers.
Exactly. Who would say such a thing?
You've identified a number of tropes now, that Venezuelans are all criminals. Another, that they're ungrateful, they reject our culture. Another is that they have special privileges. There's even something about stealing husbands.
Yeah. This being going on not only in Peru, but in Colombia and the other countries, people were complaining about how beautiful Venezuelan women were. So that was a crisis and infidelity. An actual government official in Colombia said that infidelity was rising, and that was because there were so many Venezuelans, and some of them were beautiful women.
Some of these countries have now tried to roll up the welcome mat to reverse their policies.
Right. What Peru, Chile, and other countries are doing now is asking for a passport to Venezuelans who wants to get into our countries. Until very recently, until October, actually, Venezuelans didn't need a passport to get into our country. We were accepting their ID card because to get a passport in Venezuela nowadays is impossible.
It's almost the equivalent of building a wall because you need so many dollars to get a passport.
There are some reports saying that you will pay about $1,000 in the black market in Venezuela in order to get a passport. And $1,000, no one has seen that amount of money in a long time.
The story that Radio Ambulante tells is a very familiar one. We see it playing out in Europe as well, where the Syrian refugees at first were welcomed and then regarded as a scourge and created a big right-wing backlash that is growing and growing and growing.
Unfortunately, this is just the Latin American version of what we've seen first in the States, also in Europe, all across the world. The thing that makes those stories very similar is how quickly everything changes. I was a migrant myself. I lived in Spain for 10 years, and I was very lucky because I had a good job. I was a writer, I was a journalist, I was part of a community of people who were more tolerant or curious about me and my country. But I also saw the way people in Spain treated other kind of migrants from other countries.
Yeah, you've seen this movie before.
Exactly. But, you know, to be an optimist in a way, at some point, that's an opportunity too. You know, that's an opportunity for media and for politicians to do it better the next time. Governments should be more careful the way they deal with it, and the media, of course, have to be more careful with the information they amplify.
Well, Diego, thank you very, very much.
It was my pleasure, Bob. Thank you very much.
Diego Salazar is a journalist based right now in Lima, Peru. He's also the author of We've Learned Nothing, which is a book and a journalism blog. Diego is featured in the latest episode of the Spanish language podcast Radio Ambulante on the migration issue. And you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Diego Salazar hopes we can learn from our errors. Modern history suggests it's unlikely. It was only in 1939 that Cuba, the United States, and Canada turned away the SS St. Louis, sending 900 Jewish refugees back to Nazi terror. Since 2015, governments across Europe have moved to close their borders and reject Syrian refugees, to say nothing of other displaced populations around the world, such as the Palestinians. New Yorker staff writer Masha Gessen says that for refugees, being in limbo, constantly waiting, typifies, quote, a defining condition of powerlessness in the modern world. But if the power to offer refuge is in the hands of the hostile, the indifferent, the selfish, or simply the overwhelmed, who else is complicit? In a speech this week, Gessen said the media share responsibility for failing to fully communicate the scale and the horror of the crisis. She joins us now. Masha, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Whether we're speaking of Hondurans in Mexico or Syrians in the Netherlands or Venezuelans in Peru, or for that matter, Russians in the United States, the individual stories are often so wrenching. We cover the impact of migrants on the host society, but we somehow fail to grapple with the horror that they're fleeing. War, crime, racism, sectarian violence, starvation, whatever might be compelling them to give up everything. To start with absolutely nothing somewhere else, and maybe in a society more hostile than welcoming. It is kind of hard to fathom.
Yes. There's an insidious sort of motivation behind not focusing on some of the wrenching stories. Some of the time when extremely well-intentioned people make the argument for immigration, they do it not from the point of view of need, but from the point of view of contribution. There's a widespread well-intentioned argument of immigrants are good for the society, they're good for the economy, they're productive members of the society, they pay taxes, which I find highly objectionable because I think that the argument should be not that the immigrants are good, but that we're good, right? The society has an obligation. It should be at least good enough to meet its international obligations to asylum seekers, at least that good, preferably better.
I should note that you were the recipient of the Christopher Hitchens Prize very recently, which is awarded for, quote, commitment to free expression and the pursuit of truth without regard to personal or professional consequence. And one of the most poignant passages of your acceptance speech concerned journalistic power. And you noted that your coverage over the last few years actually influenced the outcomes of certain individual cases. And yet these experiences haunt you. Why?
I'd say there are at least three stories that I have written in the last year that probably had a better outcome for the people I wrote about than if I hadn't written about them. In one case, somebody was able to avoid deportation. In two cases, people got asylum. There's nothing better for an asylum claim than having a high-profile journalist write about you in a high-profile publication. To be honest, I find it more terrifying than gratifying, in part because I'm also aware of the stories I haven't written. These are not abstractions. I know which stories I haven't written. There's a story that I was following, but I haven't written, about several men from Russia who are on hunger strike at a detention facility in Oregon, and one of them died last week. There's a story that I haven't written about two transgender women from Chechnya who managed to smuggle themselves across the border with Mexico and have been in a detention facility in Chicago for a while. There's a story I haven't written about a couple of gay academics from Russia who have been separated now for about a year. I haven't written those stories because I've been writing other stories, and because these stories, one story is a little bit more difficult to report than other stories, two stories are a little bit less dramatic than other stories that I have written. You know, however I frame it, I'm engaging in a kind of calculus about what I'm going to write, and therefore who might benefit from being written about.
You have a suggestion for solving the not enough of Masha Gessen to go around problem.
It's not just the not enough of Masha Gessen to go around problem. It's also the problem of tackling this overwhelming issue of displaced people by writing representative stories. So my proposed solution, which is probably impossible, but I propose we try it anyway, is inspired by the New York Times coverage of 9/11. If you remember, the Times ran small biographies of every single person they could identify who had died in the Twin Towers. And I think the logic behind that was that there was no single story or no set of stories that could be stand-in for a tragedy that was particularly horrifying because of its scale. The Twin Towers was an unimaginable but measurable problem of scale. The same is true with immigration. It's unimaginable, but it's also measurable. What if we tried to write all the stories of immigration? We can't run 65 million stories. That is not physically possible. But we could, for example, write about nothing but immigration for a day. And then we could do it again. And maybe that would go a way toward conveying the scale of the problem.
Is this idea to be taken literally?
Yes, this idea is to be taken literally.
But we could ask the same for climate coverage, or racism, or misogyny, dictatorship, malaria, all these horrendous conditions that never get their due in the New York Times or anywhere else, because there's so much horror of every variety out there. Journalism is, of necessity, a game of picking and choosing. My question isn't only, is it really doable? My question is it even fair?
You know, that question is actually, weirdly enough, a variety of whataboutism. This is not a suggestion of a change in approach to journalism in general. And I'm not saying that every time we face a problem of coverage or a problem of the inadequacy of journalism, here I have come up with a solution. We could just like write about nothing else for a day. I'm saying, here's an idea that I think might go a way toward doing our job better on this particular issue. And this particular issue, I think, is important enough. And by important enough, I mean that the presence of 65 million displaced people in the world is something that is destroying the world. It is destroying the lives of those 65 million people who have been rendered less than human. It is destroying the politics of entire countries and the world as a whole, because you can't have politics when 65 million people have no political rights. It is enough of a crisis, and yes, in that sense that I think it is comparable to climate change, it is enough of a crisis to do something that is absolutely extraordinary. So here's this one idea of doing something absolutely extraordinary in journalism that will perhaps be helpful, and at the very least, it will be helpful to the many people who will end up receiving the benefit of that coverage. I'm sure it's not the only solution, the only possible solution. In fact, I'm sure it's not even a solution.
Yeah, in fact, let me ask you about that. Putting aside whataboutism, let's just assume that this proposal is never actually going to materialize, that the world's press is not going to put aside everything else for one day to talk about immigration. Let's just assume that, because planes crash and politicians get assassinated. Short of that, what else can we do as an institution on a large scale to see that the stakes for societies and just plain humanity are well understood?
You know, I think I'd prefer to not answer that question. You know, my suggestion is probably insane, and you're probably right. It is a fair assumption that it's not going to happen, but this is the suggestion I have made. So I'm not going to go sort of, okay, this is my plan A, and here's my plan B, which is easier to implement. I think, you know, at least for the next few days, I'm sticking with plan A.
Well, plan A is a fetching plan.
Thank you.
Masha, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
Masha Gessen, the recipient of the Christopher Hitchens Prize, is a staff writer for The New Yorker.
Coming up, the Hanukkah story, a heroic battle against extinction by a brave and united people? Maybe not.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This weekend brings us to the tail end of Hanukkah. Judaism's 8-day Festival of Lights, marking one of God's lesser miracles involving lamp oil and the perseverance of the Jewish faith. Celebrated with dreidels and menorahs, latkes and jelly donuts, this relatively newish holiday serves, as Michael David Lucas described in the New York Times, as the Semitic sidekick to Christmas. The Hanukkah story begins in Greek-controlled Palestine over 2,000 years ago, where Jews enjoyed religious freedom. Until a new ruler, the Assyrian Greek king Antiochus, took power, as memorialized in the much-beloved 1996 Rugrats Hanukkah special.
From now on, King Antiochus says you have to wear what he wears and read what he reads. You also have to worship his gods. Some people thought this new way of life was fine, but others didn't.
If that new king catches us with our old books, we're gonna get in a lot of trouble.
I don't care. These are the books our forefathers read, and our five fathers, and our six fathers, and I'm not stopping now.
Judah, or Yehuda, and his small band of followers, the Maccabees, defeated Antiochus. After the war, under the command of Judah's priestly family, the Hasmoneans, the Jews found the Holy Temple of Jerusalem in ruins, the temple lamp with just enough oil to burn for a single day.
But one day went by, and then another, and another, until finally the 8 days had passed, and the flame was still burning. And to this day, we light the menorah every year to remember the miracle of Hanukkah.
That's the popular Hanukkah narrative, passed down through cartoons and kindergarten classes wherever Jewish kids are at risk of feeling left out at Christmas. But this holiday has a contentious past. According to Rabbi James Ponet, Hanukkah was censored for millennia because the story exposed deep divisions within the Jewish community. That and the Hanukkah miracle, he says, were undercut when the Jewish people lost their land yet again after Hasmonean infighting.
In some sense, the question is, what's the miracle here? Is it oil that burned for 8 days, or is it that for a brief period of time, in the midst of a couple hundred years in which the Jews were without political control of the land in which they lived, they achieved a political autonomy. It ended badly. The Hasmonean dynasty crumbles in a second civil war, but it happened. This is the most complex and adult of our holidays.
Wait, I thought it was like tricks. It's for kids.
Exactly. When we confront something that's completely beyond our ability to explain even to ourselves, we give it to the children. As is often the case in Mother Goose and nursery rhymes, we drum out the terror and we bring in obfuscation. So this is a story that covers over a deeper and ongoing story of a civil war. The nature of civil war then and now is that once it happens, it never stops.
Now, Judah of the Maccabees was a fundamentalist, but his principal fight was with the Assyrians, was it not?
Well, he came from the priestly family, and the priests, we're talking 165 BCE, were divided among themselves. There were those who wished to blend in, who thought that the uniqueness of Judaic practices could be abandoned. And there were others, and this was Judah and his family, that were committed to maintaining the traditions that went back to the Bible. It was a fight among priests, and it was therefore a fight among Jews. The nation has a will to live separate and a will to be part of something larger. We see this as part of the history of humanity.
This holiday may have been incorporated into a kind of Independence Day for a dynasty that lasted about 80 years, the Hasmonean dynasty. Then it was pretty much hushed up. It's not actually in the Bible, right? It's part of the Apocrypha and not generally where we find our holidays.
Exactly. Already in the second, third century, the rabbis who formed the Talmud determined that the books of Maccabees would not be included in the Bible. In fact, we don't have any of them even in Hebrew left. Why? Because these books stirred up a memory of political revolt that cost the Jewish people terribly. The rabbis couldn't drown completely the collective memory, but they could reshape it. The miracle is not in the books of Maccabees. Mm-hmm. The miracle of oil that burned is a creation of the Talmudic rabbis. So the Talmud was written in the aftermath of political and military and diplomatic failure. Now, my feeling is they wanted to bury the story. It didn't serve the interests of the Jewish people. It was really until 1948 we were living still with the sense that we couldn't be a nation state until the Messiah came. Hanukkah is an attempt to reshape the memory of the war of Jew against Jew, as well as a war of Jews against a foreign oppressor. So let's refocus it on the temple and on a miracle that happened in the temple.
It was the Talmudic scholars who reshaped it that way. If you go back to the books of the Maccabees, they do tell us about the Jewish Civil War. Here's a quote from it. There were some evildoers in Israel who tried to win popularity for a policy of integration with the surrounding nations. It was because the Jews had kept themselves aloof for so long, they claimed, that so many hardships had befallen them. They applied to Antiochus, who authorized them to introduce the Greek way of life. They built a Greek gymnasium in Jerusalem and even had themselves uncircumcised. Ouch.
Exactly. What a stunning example of the radical capacity of the Jewish people then and now to will itself out of separateness, out of particularity, out of the burden of being a small, embattled nation into a larger participation of the super global culture of the day. We're still caught in that struggle.
You co-officiated Chelsea Clinton's interfaith wedding in 2010. Interfaith ceremonies are probably the most controversially assimilative thing that a rabbi could do.
That's correct. I think of myself as in some way embodying every way there is of being a Jew today. Mm-hmm. Some Jews are atheists. I know the atheist in myself. Some Jews are ultra-Orthodox, Haredim. I know the Haredi Jew in me. I believe in the reality of a Jewish people that is at war in many ways against itself, but I embrace every aspect of it in an attempt to live within the war zone without going fully to war.
Getting back to the political evolution of the holiday. It was rediscovered in modern times to enable Jewish kids not to feel left out during this season, but it was also embraced by the Zionists and proto-Zionists.
Yes, the image of the Jew as a military figure is absolutely critical to the standing and stability of the state of Israel. As a matter of fact, the tactics that Moshe Dayan deployed in the 67 war, the Six-Day War, actually benefited from a reading of the tactics used by the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, against the Seleucidian Greek armies.
Is it fair to say that Hanukkah feels a bit more urgent lately?
It is our most urgent holiday because it's the holiday of the will to power and the dangers of power. It is a holiday that is both a call to arms and a warning about what arms can bring about. It's all there. The Jews of the diaspora are choosing not to be fully part of the political exercise of power in Israel today. That allows them to articulate the Jewish voice of moral vision, why we are in the world, while many of the Jews living in the state of Israel today pay the price of being a Jewish national entity in the world. It's part of the secret, I think, of who we are, that we live both in this state and outside of this state. And so what happened in Pittsburgh...
That was the synagogue shooting in October. Some might see that as a sign that we're vulnerable, we have to take arms, we have to leave America and go to Israel. And then others who say, hey, look, we're not alone. We got solidarity.
You're right. There were allies. There were Muslims, blacks, and others that ran to our aid. And there were policemen who were on our side. It wasn't a pogrom, although some Jews in the United States experienced it that way. And the media kind of flamed it that way, a pogrom. And yet, it was a tragic invasion of innocent people. And now synagogues in America will be ringed with police, I imagine, for quite some time. The right wing in Israel believes that we are terribly vulnerable. We could be destroyed, God forbid, at any time. The left wing believes we are completely insensitive to the moral blindness that motivates us and that we are strong enough to make major sacrifices so that we can bring about peace.
Mm. How would you prefer we celebrate Hanukkah?
I think it needs to be opened up to the most serious kind of discussion, such as you and I are having today. What does it mean to be a Jew in the world? The miracle of Hanukkah is that the Jews returned to the world. They didn't just leave it. You know, there was an attempt then, and there have been repeated attempts to remove the Jews from the world. So there's a miraculous sense that a people that was doomed recreated its old language, has taken political control of its own land, and is now in the deeply ambiguous and sometimes very ugly and brutal moral frontier of being a nation state in an age where the nation state is itself, as a system, facing a possible extinction, and greater than that, the larger possible extinction, God forbid, of the whole species, as we look at universal issues that we Jews need to address. That complexity is what Hanukkah is about, who we are.
So you would love it if we would celebrate Hanukkah asking those questions, but absent those questions, would we be better off without it?
I don't think so, because...
Because the kids would get depressed.
Well, the kids would get depressed. We would be diminished without that memory. It's like saying if we could redo Jewish history so that World War II didn't happen, wouldn't you do that? Doing that would be like attempting to turn life into a fairy tale.
Much of the Bible is a fairy tale.
Either it's a fairy tale or it is some kind of a deep expression of something going on in the Jewish imagination that is alive and well still. It's hard to be a human being. Therefore, it's hard to be a Jew. Shfer tzezani yid. I wouldn't give it up. I wouldn't give it up. I would keep it.
A Jew invented the term the melting pot?
Yes, Israel Zangwill created that term, the melting pot, which was then taken over in the United States. This goes back, of course, to, a Jewish war between, say, the prophet Isaiah, who saw that the vision of the end of time, Achrit Yamim, would be that all nations would come to Jerusalem, that the norm of humanity would be Jerusalem, over against Micah, who saw that each nation would have its own God. But both of them felt that either through a universal standardization or through a pluralism, there would come about an era where nation would not lift up sword against nation. They yearned for and believed that peace could come, but they were prepared to live in the pre-utopian world. And that seems to me the art of being a Jew, somehow finding a way to live in the world even as you are at war against it and against yourself. And yeah, that strikes me as the stuff of this holiday. So I wouldn't get rid of it, not at all.
Rabbi James Ponette is the Emeritus Howard M. Holtzman Jewish Chaplain at Yale University and the author of the Slate piece titled Hanukkah as Jewish Civil War.
Is this the eighth night? We light with family. Recall with great pride our escape from great tyranny.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Oster Chattaverdi. We had more help from Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.